Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Well, let's set the Business Week agenda, understand what investors may be thinking going into this week. Gina Martin Adams with us, Chief Equity Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from New Jersey. So, Gina, nice to have you with us. A little bit of a different tone. What are investors thinking about today?
Yeah, well, first, thank you for having me. It's always good to join you guys on a Monday afternoon. In terms of what investors are thinking, I think this all actually started as of Thursday's trade. We noticed in our chart book last week that some of the stocks that really got us into this mess, namely the technology, communications, consumer discretionary, some of those really high flyers over the summer had finally reached some signals of stabilization as of Thursday's trade. So we started to see a little bit of recovery in the broad market on Friday, and I think this is a lot of follow-through of that recovery, though I think it's really notable that it's not tech that's leading. And this has been part of our strategy really since the beginning of September. Our sector scorecard suggested that we were moving into a new phase of the market where the leadership would have to rotate to the sectors where we're supposed to experience the biggest economic recovery into 2021 eventually. And that means not the tech COVID sort of safety plays, but more value, cyclical type of stocks like the industrials and materials
and energy
of the world, and even energy. So I think that what's happening is a bit of rotation, and finally you get the tech sector stabilizing, so your primary source of downdraft in stocks is stable, and that allows for the sectors that have actually been performing reasonably well, like industrials and materials, to perform and to continue to show that leadership.
Well, and I do wonder, Gina, and first of all, we love having you, so it's a great way for us to start off our week. Do you feel like you're getting more visibility at all from CEOs? Jason and I talked to a lot of CEOs, and I still feel like there's still that, like, yeah, we don't quite know what's going, you know, on into 2021. But do you feel like you're starting to get a little bit more guidance, certainly when it comes to earnings and earnings growth?
Yeah, I think you're getting guidance on some things, but not on others.
Okay, so yeah.
I think CEOs are picking and choosing very carefully where they can provide visibility, they will. For instance, you know, if you flash back 6 months ago, there was no visibility because companies were scrambling to such an extent that they were just working to survive, let alone thrive. And I think that the conversation is slowly shifting to how do we thrive? How do we do well in an environment where we do have a lot of people still working from home? There are still a lot of unemployed, but there is incremental improvement in the economy. How do we navigate an economy that's partially open but operating in a different way than a 2019 economy? It's certainly not the crisis mode that we were in the fall, But I do think that there is a little bit more forward-looking commentary, more focus on how to grow rather than just how to survive. Now that we've gotten past the peak of the crisis period, it's about how do we navigate this new recovery. You know, that said, nobody has fantastic visibility into what the economy is going to look like in 2021, obviously.
Yeah.
But there are some signs of light. There are some signs of improvement. There are the CEOs that have had the experience of recovery in China and can kind of take that story of Asian recovery and place it on the Western world and say, well, where could we go from here? And what does our outlook look like in a post-COVID environment?
Yeah, it's also interesting, Gina, and I know this is a loaded word when it comes to markets, but there's almost this sense of capitulation or maybe resignation that, listen, the virus is going to be with us for some amount of time and maybe longer than we certainly thought in March or April, but we're learning to live with it in a certain way. Obviously, the next few months are going to be difficult and we don't know what to expect, but investors sort of living with it to some extent and getting and maybe understanding that the new normal is a new normal with the virus, not a new normal post virus in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on correct. And that's the change in the language, right? If you think 6 months ago it was, okay, well this might go away soon, and then it was, okay, it's never gonna go away. And now it's, well, we're going to make incremental progress to improvement, but the reality is we're not going to go back to 2019 anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's not going to just completely go away, but it also is not going to be crisis mode forever.
Right.
So I think we're trying to find that middle ground.
Right.
It's a little bit more about realism and assessing where the realistic outlook is. At the same time, there obviously is a lot of fireworks coming out of Washington. I mean, you've got everything from It's amazing how much we are contending with in terms of just political volatility right now.
Yeah.
In the midst of this virus environment. And so I think that companies are going to have to address that in the post-election period when we know who the players are in Washington.
Right.
Right. And we don't even know when we're going to know at this point. So that is up for speculation. All right. Gina Martin Adams, thank you so much. Great way to start the week. Chief Equity Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from New Jersey.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
While global COVID-19 cases topping 33 million as infections in India reach the 6 million mark, the official death toll nearing 1 million worldwide, though experts say the real tally may be almost double that. Let's get back to someone. He has been one of our go-to voices during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Sandro Galea is back with us, Dean and Professor at Boston University School of Public Health, author of Pained, Uncomfortable Conversations About the Public's Health. And he joins us once again on the phone from Boston. Dr. Galea, so nice to have you back with Jason and myself. How are you? How's the school? Tell us how things are going.
Hi, Carol. Hi, Jason. Thank you for having me again. You know, it has been a challenging month. I think it's a challenging month for everybody who is part of an institution that is trying to balance the risks of the moment. We as a university have been reopening cautiously, carefully, with a lot of testing, a lot of contact tracing, a lot of isolation as needed, and really working hard to keep the community safe while also working on our mission and continuing teaching and continuing our research. It's a tough balance. I think it's a tough balance for everybody, and it's part of, I think, a broader societal place where we are at, where we are recognizing that we are living with COVID for some time now, and we cannot afford to keep our world slow down because there are important things that we have to do.
And so give us a sense of that balance, Dr. Galea. Like, what is something where you feel like you've found it in terms of either staffing or class size or doing labs? Like, give us an example of where you feel like, okay, well, this feels about as good as we can get.
Well, Jason, I think I don't think I feel confident telling you anything is as good as it can be. I think everything is a work in progress. But you know, let's talk a little bit about what we're doing. So we, as a university, are testing people extensively. We have about 5,000 to 6,000 tests a day happening. So students are tested multiple times a week. We have a lot of people who are involved both in the testing, but then also if somebody tests positive and the contact tracing to see who they've been in contact with, right? So the idea is, and we had discussed this before in our previous conversations, the idea with testing is that you catch a case early so that it does not become a cluster that does not then continue the epidemic. So you find a case, you do contact tracing, you find the people around that case, you quarantine those people and you isolate the case. And of course, all of that is superimposed over a very strict regimen of building hygiene. And by that, I mean ventilation in the building, wiping down surfaces, a very strong public campaign for people to remain safe, wearing masks, making sure that people are not in if they're sick, and every day doing symptom screens for everybody. So it really is a fairly comprehensive effort. And it is, in some respects, I think the challenge is that it's a comprehensive effort that has to happen now and has to keep happening really for weeks and months until there is a definitive vaccine for COVID.
Talk to me about contact tracing, because I feel like we are getting very mixed results, mixed reviews in terms of people essentially saying, yep, not going to cooperate. It's voluntary. Right, I'm not going to tell you. Either I don't want to get in trouble because I was at a party, or I feel like it's an invasion of my privacy. How do you manage that?
Well, in some respects, I think it's easier to manage that within a closed system of one institution versus in the general population, right? So in our system, we have been very clear that this is part of the cost of citizenship. If you're going to be part of the community, you have a responsibility to work towards keeping others safe. And part of that responsibility is, if you test positive, is that you talk to the contact tracers and you tell them who you've been in contact with so that they can reach out to those people and make sure we keep them safe as well. It's harder to do that in the general population. There's been a lot of reports about 50% of people in general population answer and talk to contact tracers. That's in the general population, where I think there isn't as much of a sense of shared responsibility for one another. There should be. I'm just reflecting on probably what's going on out there.
Yeah, no, that's a big part of it. I mean, Jason, you and I have talked about it. I know when my daughter got together with some classmates at the end of the summer and we had kind of quarantined her for months, you know, we as families went into it saying, okay, what have you been doing? Who's getting tested? You know, like, there was this sense of community to make sure everybody stayed safe. And I feel like, you know, there, not everybody's on the same page with that. Also, to be fair, and Dr. Galea, you understand this, not everybody can be on the same page. There are some people that, you know, if they don't go to work, they don't get paid, and it they're in a tougher predicament. And I just, you know,
this is why, Carol, I think the reopening is so important. I think it's, you know, the data are very clear, for example, that your chances of being able to work from home are much higher if you're in the top 25% quartile of income. So people who have to go to work are people who are already making less income. We know that that overlaps with race, right? We know that the disproportionate burden of COVID in many respects was because we exposed people with low income, people of color often, to work before we understood how COVID works. But the economic shutdown, I feel like the public conversation about the economic slowdown hasn't been fair, because to be frank, it's been directed by people whose livelihoods are not really at risk from economic slowdown because they can work from home. But the fact is, more than half the population cannot work from home.
Right.
So if we take the premise that, well, we should reduce the risk of COVID at all costs, well, do we really mean at all costs, or do we mean at all costs to somebody else?
Right.
And I think
we
need to be honest with that. And economic slowdowns hurt people who are already at the low end of making income. And that is something that we as a society have a responsibility to try to avoid as much as possible.
Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, also the author of the book Pained, Uncomfortable Conversations About the Public's Health. So let's talk about the public's health, Dr. Galea. What can we be doing before we get to the other side of this? What should we be doing to ensure that we don't lose sight of these inequalities that have been laid bare by this pandemic?
Well, Jason, I think what the pandemic has shown us, and I like your use of the term laid bare, it has shown us the inequalities that existed already before the pandemic. The country is really shaped by deep socioeconomic inequalities and deep racial inequalities. And those inequalities have health analogs, just like we have haves and have-nots, we have health haves and have-nots around those two axes. Now, the pandemic revealed that. We have Black Americans have 2.5 times greater risk of dying during COVID than white Americans. And that is largely due to the double whammy of, one, greater burden of disease among that Black Americans had compared to white Americans, and number two, that a disproportionate number of them work in what we came to call sort of essential work, frontline work, work that exposed them to getting COVID. So to my mind, what COVID is now letting us see what was already there for us to see had we looked for it. So the question you ask is, how do we not forget this? And I think we do not forget this, frankly, by continuing to have the conversation and saying to ourselves, the time to fix these inequities by socioeconomic class, by race, is not when we're under duress from a pandemic. It's when the pandemic is over, before the next pandemic. So I really think that there's going to be, and there should be, a reckoning with what are the forces in our society, the economic forces, the social forces, that we need to realign once the pandemic's over. You know, the metaphor that keeps running through my mind is you're on a ship going through a storm, right? And you're on a ship going through a storm, and the ship is not doing well because it's leaking or because the sailors don't know what they're doing. Well, while you're going through the storm, the best you can do is try to patch up the prow and get your sailors to do something that's not too terrible. But really, the time when you should be fixing the ship is when you're past the storm. So you should be getting the ship ready to face the next storm. And we as a country have ignored this for decades. So it is, I mean, if one were to be silver lining inclined, this could be a good time for reflection for us once we get past this pandemic and say, what are the structures we want to build to make the country healthier and ready for the next time?
Well, what would be the structures you would build?
Well, I think the big mistake, Carol, that we've been making is we conflate healthcare with health. We spend more on healthcare than any other country in the world by a lot, by about 40% more than any other country in the world. And yet, compared to other high-income countries, which is really the only fair comparison, we have the worst health indicators compared to, you know, we have lower life expectancy, we have higher heart disease, we have higher cancer mortality rates. Now, why is that? The reason that is very simple. It's because all our money goes into high-tech medicine that's there to cure us when we're already sick. What we need to do is we need to prevent disease before it starts. And the way to do that is by having livable wages, safe housing, availability of nutritious food, gender equity, less violence. And unless we invest in those forces, we are going to keep pumping money into healthcare and our health is still going to lag behind. So that's at the fundamental level. It requires understanding what produces health and investing in what produces health, not just investing in healthcare.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
So important.
I like that. Dr. Sandro Galea, thank you so much. Really nice to have you back with us. We look forward to next time for sure. Dean of Boston University School of Public Health, also the author of Pained, Uncomfortable Conversations About the Public's Health. And it's such an important point, Carol.
Yeah.
And I had never really heard it distilled down like that. We separate healthcare from health. We do think of it. We think about it when we talk about it from an investment perspective. Well, it's the healthcare industry. But all of those things that he talked about, and education, I feel like there's a pretty clear path to. But nutrition, I feel like sometimes food, we separate from health.
Oh, we totally do. But I thought what he said about livable wages, safe housing, you wouldn't necessarily correlate that, right, with better health either.
Yeah.
But it's all intertwined.
Yeah.
You need all those steps.
Totally.
That whole last thing, how he tied it up, I thought was just brilliant.
Yeah.
That's all right. A t-shirt all on its own.
There
that's like,
you go.
That's like a jogging suit.
Jogging
plus socks
suit.
And sneaks, I'm just going to say.
Courtesy of Dr. Sandro Galea.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about this next story because it's just in such the Bloomberg wheelhouse and so appropriate for a time when we're talking so much about
it could be a Netflix series too.
And how it's managed. I know. It's so great. Neil Weinberg, one of our favorite reporters here, a senior projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from New York, along with Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us from Massachusetts. And Joel, I feel like this is also one of these stories that's so in the Joel Weber wheelhouse, too, because you were the editor of Bloomberg Markets before you became the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. So you understand all the intricacies of this world. Set this up for us.
It's funny. It actually makes me remember a very similar story that Neil did for me once upon a time that actually goes to some similar places. And this is a story that Neil spent a lot of time on, and it's a really interesting one because it involves rich people and their bankers. And if that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what does.
Especially Neil, here in September 2020, yeah, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Neil, let's talk about this, because it's not a story that goes particularly well for the rich guy, or at least it hasn't so far. What are we talking about?
No, I guess the sort of conceit of the story is the idea that when you're talking about private banking, the banking for the super rich, you're talking about a service that you don't get walking into your local branch office. And this goes, obviously, to things like investing and putting your money in savings accounts, but it also goes to things that can include outside investments or sports tickets or dinner reservations or private planes or you name it. And they'll arrange it for you. And the question in the story is, at what point does it stop becoming banking and become something else? At what point are the clients lulled into sort of a sense of comfort with their bankers where they're not exactly trusting but verifying?
Yeah.
Who are the characters that you're talking about here, Neil?
In this case, we're talking about a extremely wealthy young Mexican gentleman named Moises Cosío Espinosa. He inherited a lot of money at a very young age when he was in his teens. Among his holdings is a building 59 stories on the corner of 5th Avenue and 42nd Street across from the New York Public Library, to name one. So he had a lot of money at a very young age, and he was introduced to a pretty young banker, a banker who at the time was in his 20s, and they struck up a relationship which, from our reporting, indicates that it was professional. It was also social, and the story gets into the dark corners of, you know, what is trust and what is appropriate in banking and beyond.
Well, and I also feel like, you know, Neil, that it raises questions like, are these relationships usually mutually beneficial? I mean, there's fees that the banker gets for doing transactions and so on and so forth. But I do wonder, there's a balance, right? And I feel like this story gets to, did the bankers go, you know, over the line in terms of what they did?
Absolutely. And obviously, you're always going to have attention in a sales environment, whether you're selling cars or computers or banking services, where the more revenue you generate for your employer probably means you'll get paid more, too, which was the case here. And on the other hand, obviously, it's a good deal for a client to get a good deal. So you have to sort of strike a balance. And in this case, after many years where the banker and the client were working together, the client came to the conclusion that, no, he wasn't getting good service. He was getting ripped off.
Neil, another element that kind of stands out here is that the banker in question, who obviously has disputed the allegations, wasn't like he stuck at one bank, right? He actually moved around and brought the client with him. Talk to us about that element.
Exactly. This was a banker who started in his 20s after he had skied in the Olympics, of all things, a fellow Mexican. He joined Citibank. He then moved for a larger pay package to Credit Suisse and ultimately ended up at Morgan Stanley in Miami, where he was part of the Latin American practice. The client, Moises Cosío, followed him from one bank to the next, set up a family office along the way, and he hired to run his family office another banker who was very familiar to both the banker and the client, which raised questions about conflicts of interest and whether the relationship was too cozy for comfort, or at least too cozy to work appropriately.
Well, so I wonder if the problems are because the investments didn't pay off, and that's why we had lawsuits, because I feel like these cozy relationships maybe would be okay if everything went along fine. Is it a case that things didn't go so well, and that's why we have lawsuits? I mean, I guess this is what we're trying to figure out.
Well, it's important to say in this case, it's a hotly disputed legal dispute at this point, but what the client is alleging in a lawsuit and in a private arbitration before FINRA is that the bankers, he says, stepped way over the line, and they were doing transactions inside the bank. In this case, the bank he is pointing a finger at is Credit Suisse, and he is saying that the bankers were doing transactions purely to profit themselves and their employer. In addition, he's alleging that they encouraged him to get involved in outside investments, sort of private equity or private placement type of deals, where they say there was a lot of self-dealing going on. The bankers, the one who was inside the bank and the one who was running the family office, have vehemently denied the allegations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you talk about in this story where, you know, the lines blur in part because these are not always traditional straight ahead investments. And so it's hard, especially if you're not well versed in this area, to even know sort of what's cool and what is not cool.
Exactly. And the other question is, at what point should a client who is in control at a young age of tens or hundreds of millions of dollars or potentially more, how much attention should they pay? Should they have advisors to keep an eye on their advisors? In this case, you know, exactly what happened depends on which side you ask, but
yeah.
Clearly the relationship went way off the rails.
Yeah.
Well, not surprisingly, it is one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg and will continue to be. I have to imagine a lot of our wealthier and maybe not so wealthy customers are sending this to the banker being like, hey, what? Can we call tomorrow? Can we check in?
Yeah.
All right, Neil Weinberg, terrific piece of reporting. Thank you so much. Senior Projects and Investigations Reporter for Bloomberg. Check that story out online and on the Bloomberg. Our thanks as well to Joel Weber, Carol.
It's like, whew. You got to read it, too, because there's just...
some great details.
Exactly.
Mexican restaurant.
And just the way
art.
It starts, it's just wonderful.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's do a little Business Week economics now. Our pal Andy Brown is back with us, editorial director for Bloomberg New Economy. He joins us on the phone from New Hampshire. So I am really into this recent column that you wrote, Andy, because it really brings to the fore something that I think is, dare I say, sort of hiding in plain sight when it comes to China, which is around climate change. Tell us what you took on.
Yeah, so the central point is that when it comes to climate change, China is at war with itself. Mm. You know, on the one hand, it's a global superpower when it comes to renewable energy, batteries, solar, wind. On the other hand, you know, it mines and burns half the world's coal. And right now, it has in its development pipeline power stations with either approved or about to get the green light with a capacity equal to the entire installed coal capacity of the European Union. So, you know, it in a sense, it hardly matters what the rest of the world does, because China is going to swamp all of those efforts. And this is why Xi Jinping's announcement last week that China is to go carbon neutral by 2060, why it is potentially so important.
Well, and I wonder, Andy, I mean, I love what you wrote, this whole idea of two titanic forces, one clean, one dirty, that are at constant war in China's fractious domestic economy. I mean, like it or not, they still use so much coal and have to, right, as being, you know, kind of the manufacturer to the world. They've got a lot to power. I mean, they need it to keep their economy growing. But at the same time, China is increasingly, I feel like, you know, stepping into a void that the U.S. has stepped out of when it comes to, hey, world, let's all work together to protect the climate.
Exactly. So coal is shrinking in the rest of the world, and it's rising dramatically in China, particularly now that China wants to jumpstart its economy from the COVID lockdowns. It's fire up the boilers. But here's the thing: China doesn't actually need all the capacity it's building. Mm-hmm. You know, these power plants that it's cranking out add to a fleet that is in massive overcapacity, about 50%. So what's happening is that China is exporting its surplus capacity to countries along its Belt and Road infrastructure mega project, including Turkey, places like Pakistan, Indonesia. And worse than that, the technology that is exporting is its most basic, most polluting, dirtiest technology.
So, Andy, you mentioned President Xi Jinping earlier in the conversation. What is his role in all of this? Because more so, it feels like, than any world leader, he has not just a massive economy that he's responsible for, but he has control of that economy in a way that few world leaders do.
Well, that is somewhat true. But, I mean, even Xi Jinping is subject to forces that are beyond his control. And this is sort of both positive and negative. So if you think about why is China cranking out all these power plants? Well, provincial governments need growth.
Right.
And the easiest way they find to promote growth is by manufacturing, coal gear. On the other hand, he's under huge domestic pressure to do something about the environment. So the legitimacy of his party state derives and has done for the past 40 years from rapid economic growth. Increasingly, people in China are saying, we want you to prioritize clean air, clean water. So that's on the sort of the public opinion side. There's also, in a more positive vein, this idea that China could actually use renewable or green technologies to become a world economic leader, industrial leader. We've already talked about batteries and coal and so on. There are all these carbon capture and storage technologies that have yet to be developed. China could actually become the leader in these technologies of the future. So there is big incentive. On the negative side, and this is very important to him, you know, China suffers massive drought in the north. It has floods in the south. The Yangtze River has been swelling. It's putting huge pressure on the Three Gorges Dam. Huge parts of coastal China's manufacturing could disappear if you get rising sea levels. So it does have a great incentive to tackle climate.
So will it?
This is the question. So a lot of people say, well, you know, easy to say, right? Climate neutral by 2060, 40 years away. You know, that's long after Xi Jinping himself will have gone to meet Marx, as they say.
Yeah.
So people say, well, talk is cheap. We will, however, find out whether there is some substance to what he said by looking at the details in the next 5-year plan,
right.
2001 to 2025. Those will be coming out in the next few months, probably early next year. So we'll see. I don't think we shouldn't take this at face value, but nor I think should we be too skeptical.
Right. All right. Well, it's very smart as always. Great context for us to consider. Andy Brown, editorial director for Bloomberg New Economy. Check out his latest column, China Has a Big Climate Change Paradox. Just massive numbers, massive influence, but the scale of both the opportunity but also the challenge,
right?
He really laid them out nicely there.
But I do feel like anytime we talk to anybody in the alternative energy space or the EV space, they bring up China as being able, you know, that's a huge market and they're way ahead in many ways. We do want to mention a headline crossing. The Trump administration considering fresh sanctions to sever Iran's economy from the outside world, except in limited circumstances, by targeting more than a dozen banks and labeling the entire financial sector off limits. This is according to three people familiar with the matter. Our team out of D.C. Reporting this.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
The story, I think it's fair to say that just about everyone who looks at the world of politics and taxes, for that matter, was really talking about was the blockbuster report in the New York Times all about President Trump's taxes over the past two decades, what he paid, what he didn't pay. Maybe most importantly, going forward, the debt that is coming due.
Mm-hmm.
As we were reading this, we thought, who could tell us what this actually means? And we came up with the perfect solution as a team. Laura Davison, congressional tax reporter for Bloomberg. She joins us on the phone from D.C. All right. So, Laura, 9,800 words in the main story. A lot of us read it all. You read it, though, with maybe a different eye than someone who's just like, oh, what are the politics of this? Tell us what jumped out at you here.
So some of the things that it talked about, the business losses, those are sort of ordinary uses of the tax code. But in case speaking with a bunch of tax lawyers all morning, there's a bunch of things that they said, hey, that looks a little bit funky, particularly the consulting fees, those so high and going to employees like Ivanka Trump, as the report detailed. They say that is highly unusual and probably potentially could run against some IRS rules. Other things like the Seven Springs estate in Westchester County. He has two different ways that he's sort of generating tax breaks off of that. One is through this conservation easement deal where he was able to generate a really big charitable tax deduction there. Lots of questions about whether the property was really valued correctly. The IRS has identified that sort of transaction as one that's ripe for abuse. So a lot of questions there. Also, sort of on that same property, Trump has listed it as an investment property for business purposes, for tax purposes, but also publicly, and the Trump sons have said, oh, this is our family compound. On the Trump Organization website, it's listed as a family retreat. There's some discrepancies there about how it's being viewed kind of in the eyes of the tax code and then how they're actually treating it, which were things that would really raise red flags for IRS auditors.
One thing that jumps out is it also said he earned $73 million abroad in his first 2 years in the White House, including from authoritarian-leaning countries, as you point out in your story, such as the Philippines and Turkey, despite a pledge that he would pursue no new foreign deals while president. That's a big no-no.
Yeah, and this is one thing that Democrats in particular are leaning in really hard saying. This is why we need to see more of his, the full extent of his tax returns. We need to have more financial disclosures. They're really pointing that as to, something that could be an issue. There's also, some saying, look, this could be an issue for Trump in terms of him leaving office. He has all these connections. There's been a lot of kind of confusion and question thrown into, will there be a peaceful transfer of power? And this sort of adds another layer of sort of confusion and murkiness around that about what Trump's ties may be to the presidency, to his businesses, and to why kind of the stake he has in staying in the Oval Office.
So, Laura, as you were talking to tax experts today, and I guess you were texting with them last night, as we all were, trying to sort of figure out what this all means, as you had those conversations, how much of a tone of there was like, look, this is what rich guys do. They hire a bunch of lawyers. They hire a bunch of accountants. They pay as little tax as possible. And this is just kind of an extreme example of this.
I think it's a little bit more than an extreme example of, they're sort of, really using the tax code, to your advantage. And then there's maybe crossing some lines here. As the Times article details several things that tax lawyer said, hey, look, this is really beyond what I would advise my clients to do. But kind of in the bigger picture here, this really is a demonstration of how there are sort of parallel tax codes. One for sort of just, quote, average people who earn salaries versus if you have, a lot of different businesses and lots of different entities and, can employ some smart tax people, you can really save a lot more and pay a lot lower rate than someone who is, just filing with H&R Block.
But these are his actual tax forms, because it's interesting in your story, you note that a lawyer for the Trump Organization told the Times that, quote, most, if not all, of the facts appear to be inaccurate. I mean, they are reporting off of his tax forms.
Yes, they didn't validate the forms with the Trump Organization. They decided to protect their sources to keep those in-house, but they detailed, all the different information that was listed on those tax forms. So there seems to be a discrepancy that I'm not privy to between the Trump Organization and the Times. But the Times says that they obtained the forms from a source that legally had access to them and that, they verified the numbers, through reporting on their own.
What about the $300 million in loans, obligations for which the president is personally responsible that are going to come due, I think, in the next couple of years? What do we know about that?
So there's a lot of questions there about where those loans are tied to. Nancy Pelosi raised that today, House Speaker, as one of her concerns of, who has those obligations and how might he be beholden to those debtors. The other thing, too, is just sort of bigger picture. You look at Trump has a potentially very precarious financial situation going forward. He has these loans that will come due. He potentially could have a very big tax bill from the IRS. There's lots of questions about sort of his financial situation and sort of, particularly if he's
still in the government, you know, what incentives he might have to make sure that he, you know, he doesn't fold. He doesn't have to file for bankruptcy.
Right. Exactly. All right. Laura Davidson, great context. Thank you so much. Congressional tax reporter for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from the nation's capital. Everyone trying to break down what it all means and what it means going forward, Carol.
As if 2020 couldn't get any more stranger.
Oh, just wait. Just wait. We've got
time. I know.
We've got like the less than 100 days to go, but still plenty of time. We got a little
plenty
less than 40 days till the election.
Plenty of time.
Plenty of time for some more shenanigans. Don't you worry. Don't you
worry. Your pretty little head there, Ms.
Exactly.
Nassar. I knew where that was going.
No, didn't say it. Didn't say it.
I know, but you thought it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to the drive to the close. Happy to have back with us Deepak Puri. He is CIO of the Americas at Deutsche Bank Wealth Management. Join us on the phone. Deepak, really nice to have you back with us.
Great. Thank you, Jason. Good to be back.
So what are you seeing out there these days? We had a few kind of rough weeks and certainly a few rough days on the market last week, but a little more optimism today. It looks like we're going to close in the green. And we've had a couple experts ahead of you come in and say, well, some of it is just some rebalancing that's going on. Some of it is optimism about the virus. Some of it is optimism about banks. What do you see?
I think it's a combination of these things that you just mentioned, but I just would like to have your listeners go to the month of August, where the markets had a very significant rally, you know, in some cases, low double digits. So I think September looks like we're going to be still down for the month, you know, so it warrants that there was some profit taking in the month of September, which is not too out of ordinary, given it's an election year. And I do feel that the NASDAQ pullback that we saw is somewhat healthy, because some of the froth, especially in the mega cap tech names, that has been really driving not just the NASDAQ but also S&P, you know, would make some money on the sideline, make it a better, more appealing investment for the long run.
And I don't know, Jason, did you mention this, the portfolio rebalancing?
Yes,
I know. Okay. So, so I know our Vince Signorella had shared some insight with both of us earlier and talked about this, you know, month end, quarter end portfolio rebalancing. I mean, it's technical, but it happens, right? I mean, Deepak, that's what we see kind of at the end of a month or end of a quarter. And we could be seeing, you know, some investors, you know, kind of doing some rebalancing and bringing their asset allocations back in line.
Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, one should also keep in mind that the entire tax regime might also be in course for a change if there's a change in the White House, especially if there is a blue wave. You know, I don't necessarily expect that to be the first course of order, but that can potentially happen. The Biden, you know, manifesto calls for an increase of taxes on both, you know, long-term capital gains and ordinary dividends. So I think might be, you know, this time around it's a normal rebalancing quarter end, but I think end of the year rebalancing this particular year might be even more severe than what we are used to in other years.
So when you think about sort of riding out this period, you know, we're getting closer and closer to 30 days out from the election, and you alluded to some of the different plans. Do you just kind of stay still here if you're an investor and wait for it to play out? I mean, how do you anticipate or how difficult is it going to be to just kind of do that, given all the at least political and rhetorical volatility we expect to see?
Yeah, I think this has been such a unique year, Jason, and I don't think it's going to really abate anytime soon. I think we're entering this heightened period of volatility. Normally, in a general election year, that volatility tends to go down post-election. I'm not sure that this time around that happens. You know, we have already seen this rhetoric in terms of a contested election, and that might prolong the volatility. Case in point, if you look back to another contested election, 2000, you know, the S&P dropped 5% from the date of the election to the time the courts made their judgment. So, you know, what is most concerning to me this time around is that, you know, think of a couple of months ahead, you have a court deciding the outcome of the election and the Senate races. On top of that, somehow you get the second wave of infection, and there is still no tangible movement on the next COVID relief package from the Congress because everyone is so sort of focused on what's happening on the election outcome. And that sort of a cocktail could be quite negative for the risky assets. Now, that I wouldn't say that's our base case scenario, but the probability of that scenario has definitely gone up over the last month or so.
Okay, so in terms of portfolios, fixed income, equity, how do you see it? What's your ideal portfolio right now?
To be honest, it changes on a on a quite frequent basis. It hasn't, but given so much stuff happening in the market, I think ideally it's a case-by-case study, as you can imagine, Carol. So there's no one-size-fits-all. You have to look at your time horizon and what you're comfortable with in terms of drawdowns. What I would say is that the tailwind of this massive fiscal and monetary stimulus, and then I mentioned I think fiscal stimulus needs to again make a comeback, but it's just massive on a global scale. And now that you have this optimism surrounding to the vaccine, I think that adds on to the positiveness that equities represent. And in this kind of environment where everyone is going down to zero, you want to be with long-dated assets, and there's nothing more long-dated than quality equity names.
Right.
So hence one of the reasons why I feel equity still, once we get over the next couple of months, because almost everything that is of concern right now to me seems to have a calendar date of expiry. So you look at the second wave, for example, it is going to, we are going to know in the next couple of months if we are having
Exactly. Well, sorry to wrap you there, Deepak. Really appreciate your time. Deepak Puri is Chief Investment Officer for the Americas at Deutsche Bank Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from New York City. Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.